Okay, how do I sound on your end?
You sound good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you sound on my end?
It's amazing. Even better.
Hi friends, I'm Blue Mitchell. You're listening to The Diffusion Tapes, a podcast where I chat with photographers, curators, and writers working in the field of fine art photography. More specifically, these tapes are conversations with people I've befriended on my journey as an artist and publisher. So now I get to learn a little more about these folks that I admire and respect, and I'm inviting you into our conversation. Welcome to The Diffusion Tapes. Okay, here we are. You are tuned into the Diffusion Tapes. Thanks for joining me. I'm finally getting back behind the mic. So whether you're a first-time listener or a fan of our first season, my original intention of these tapes was to do all the recordings face-to-face. But of course, the pandemic ruined that concept, and I wasn't sure I was going to continue with the project. But after much consideration, time, and some big changes, I'm back at it, but recording remotely now. And I couldn't be more thrilled about these upcoming tapes. The first news is this will be the only tape I host by myself in season 2, because I've invited my guest here, Michael Kirchhoff, to be co-host going forward. So I'm pretty psyched about having Michael on the project. We've collaborated a lot throughout the years, and I think this will be our best collab yet. In our conversation, we cover a lot of what Michael is up to. Besides being a talented photographer and major photography advocate, he is the editor-in-chief at the fantastically popular Analog Forever magazine. A big fan. He's the founder of Catalyst Interviews and contributing editor over at our site, 112. And now my co-host at the Diffusion Tapes. He's much loved in our photo community, and we have a great rapport here on the tapes. I'm looking forward to a very robust season 2 with Michael, but let's hear what he has to say.
Yeah, well, at least it's not trash day. Yeah.
It is trash day here, actually.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So I guess we might hear it. I don't know.
We'll see. Oh, okay.
All right. So the first thing that's going on here for the first session of the Diffusion Tapes is I caved and now are doing remote chats, which is a new concept for me. I was very resistant to going remote for the Diffusion Tapes because my whole thing was like, oh, we record these face to face. So now it's like digital face to digital face instead.
Right. But I mean, doing it this way doesn't seem problematic at all, other than maybe some technical difficulties that, you know, the person on the other side of the camera has to deal. I mean, otherwise the reasoning for doing them all face-to-face in person was what? You wanted to just have physical contact with the person, or?
More of a relaxed conversation where you get a lot of body language.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's nice to be able to see through, you know, we can't high-five each other, but we can see kind of what's going on.
The thing with doing these remote is it increases access to people. So that helps.
Certainly,
quite a bit.
Yeah. Immensely.
Yeah, my window of opportunity is much bigger now. So,
right.
Which brings me to probably the best reason for going remote is I now have a new co-host for the Diffusion Tapes.
Who's that?
Michael Kirchhoff.
Oh, he's great. I've heard about him.
Yeah,
and I appreciate you asking me to do this. I mean, it's an honor, especially when it's something that I know that you were kind of, like you said, you were reluctant to get back into doing again. I remember when we were at Photo Lucida and we were doing the book fair together, and you had a lot of people coming up to you, and you know, you were getting a lot of compliments on what you'd been doing with the Diffusion Tapes. And I think that that was kind of, wasn't that the the spark that, that kind of got you going again?
Yeah, I just confirmed, you know, my interest.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I had all these ideas on, you know, starting over and doing more of these in person, and I even started inviting people, and then I realized that now it was going to be difficult for me schedule-wise to be doing it, but also I kind of get tired of listening to myself talk, so it's nice to have someone else around. So let's get into it.
Sure.
Michael Kirchhoff, where did you grow up?
I grew up where I'm at now. I've gone full circle over the years. I grew up in Los Angeles, California, in the suburbs, in different places, you know, outside of the downtown area, or what most people, I guess, think of as Los Angeles. I mean, that's a pretty broad term, since every single city out here grew together years and years ago. Visitors to Los Angeles just think it's just one vast wasteland, which in some ways it is, but there are differences from town to town. So it was an interesting place to grow up. When people come here, it's interesting hearing their remarks about the city that you grew up in and how immense it is and how it's difficult to get around. It's so challenging geographically. But to me, it's always just kind of been normal. So when I did leave here, I left for Santa Barbara, which is obviously a sleepier beach town, especially at that time. And I went to school there for a while and then moved to San Francisco, where it's a lot of people and it's much more compact. You know, my world changed dramatically when I left Los Angeles, but I did end up moving back. Gosh, I don't even know. I remember 92, 5 days before the riots broke out.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What were you doing in San Francisco?
Working. I mean, that's where I kind of started my photographic career. I had moved in with my girlfriend who I was dating in Santa Barbara, and then we moved in together. We had been going to school at Brooks Institute together. And then we started assisting other photographers. And she was interested in people and fashion and that kind of work. And I was interested in product, tabletop, food. And then to a certain degree, kind of, you know, landscape from a fine art perspective. Although that was not, we were both trying to earn a living. And that didn't seem like the place that I needed to be in order to make a living, you know. Commercial photography was everything that was being concentrated on at that time. And thankfully, San Francisco was a really great city to be in creatively, even from a commercial photography standpoint. There were some really amazing photographers working there. And obviously, the bigger ones got a lot of their work from outside of the city as well. You know, they were tapped into a lot of the bigger New York ad agencies and stuff. So they had a lot of great clients and people were really willing to explore creatively, even in the advertising realm. It seems like to a certain degree that went away for a while, but is kind of coming back again. But it was really a wonderful place to be. I was there for a total of about 3 years before moving back to Los Angeles.
Okay. Do you have a standout shoot that you did?
In San Francisco?
Yeah.
A standout shoot. You know, there were... Well, first of all, most of the work that I ended up doing, I ended up cold calling a gentleman by the name of Alan Ross. And even though I had read about him in Ansel Adams' biography, when I called him, I didn't recognize his name or it didn't dawn on me who he was when I reached out. You know, I was just looking for work as an assistant or a printer or, you know, even a PA. Like I had to make a living. Like I'd left school and I had to work. So I met him and realized that he was Ansel Adams' former assistant and the last assistant to go out in the field with him to actively make photographs. And to that day, or to even to this day, he still prints the special edition prints from Ansel's original negatives that they sell at the Ansel Adams Gallery. And when I met with him, he said, well, let's go upstairs and hang out and talk a little bit about what it is that you do and what it is that I need. You know, we kind of went through all that. Well, during our discussion, I remember looking around the room and kind of looking at the prints on the wall and the posters. And then I realized how much of it I recognized. And then I realized that none of them were posters at all. They were all original prints. And there was a multitude of original Ansel Adams prints on the wall. There was also a very large...
Oh, well, how big were they?
They were, I would say, I think they were all, I would say 16 by 20, 20 by 24-ish.
Okay.
Somewhere in that range. There were some smaller ones too, but most of them were larger. And then there was a very large Georgia O'Keeffe watercolor on the wall as well. And I was kind of like, wow, what's up? Like, this guy's really... really into Ansel, kind of quite the collector. and then he brought up the fact. Yeah, and then he brought up the fact that, you know, he said, well, if you come to work for me as an assistant, you know, he was a food photographer, but he, you know, obviously had his fine art side, but again, like me, like he had to work and he had to make a living. So food photography and a little bit of product photography was kind of his specialty. So that's why I was there. And he said, well, if you come to work with me, a lot of what you'll have to do is work in the darkroom. And I was like, that's great. That's like a dream job. You know, if I could do some you know, lighting in the studio and then spend some time in the darkroom doing whatever needs to be done, processing, printing, you name it, finishing, I'm into it. Yeah. Count me in. And then he brought up the fact that he used to work with Ansel Adams. And I was just like, Oh my God. And I immediately like broke into a cold sweat and I was like, wait a minute. So this guy wants me to come and work with him in the dark room. And I immediately got very kind of flabbergasted. And
did you feel like, oh shit, I'm over my head?
Oh, absolutely. Like my anxiety just like shot through the roof. And as soon as that happened, he was like, yeah, so I think that, you know, you should come to work for me. And like, I got something coming up next week. Do you want to, you can kind of come on in. And I was like, well, sure. I guess I can do that. So I did. And, you know, I ended up working for him very frequently. I wasn't the only assistant that worked with him. There were a couple of others. But towards the end of the 3 years that I spent working with him, I think I was kind of I was more or less the primary one who was in the studio and in the darkroom with him. Mm-hmm. So. And we did a lot of stuff, and he let me use the dark room. He was very generous. He was, I think I probably learned more from him in the 3 years that I worked with him. And it was like wasn't a full-time gig, right? It was just kind of, it was freelance, but it was frequent, you know, it happened frequently. But I learned as much from him that I did in all of my years of schooling.
No, I bet.
He was the consummate problem solver. And I think it was while working with him that I realized that was the primary job of a commercial photographer, is you were a problem solver. You know, the client would come into you with an idea, and in order to execute that idea, you had to solve a series of problems to make it happen the way that they wanted.
Sure, yeah.
And watching Alan, he had his own little workshop. You know, there was a studio, there was a great kitchen. There was upstairs in the loft area, there was like his office, and then there was like a finishing area where print, you know, he would have prints drying, and then when I would help him do like exhibitions of his own, I kind of did all the prep work, you know, I got all the prints ready to be signed, and then I think I did some matting for him for a while, a little bit of framing, and, you know, it was kind of a trial by fire. I did kind of feel like I was in over my head, but he was so gracious and giving with everything that I, you know, I felt very comfortable very quickly.
So, right. How old are you during this time?
I think I had just turned 22.
Okay. Youngster.
I was, yeah. Young and stupid. Boy, that's for sure. But, you know, you know, I didn't know it at the time, you know. You know, you think you kind of go into something like that. And yeah, you know, after a short time of doing it, like I said, I felt very comfortable, you know, like I think a little bit of not ego, but that being comfortable in your own skin really kind of came out at that point.
Yeah. Confidence.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, you're right. It wasn't ego. It was strictly confidence. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've ever been an egotistical person. I don't see myself.
You don't come across that way.
I can't see myself that way. Maybe other people do. I don't know. But
oh yeah, we talk shit about you behind your back all the time.
As you should. Yeah. I mean, that's that's okay, because I talk shit about myself in front of people all of the time as well. I mean, if
that Kirchhoff guy.
Yeah, if I'm going to get cut down, I'm going to be doing it first. So that's kind of just something. That's just kind of me. Like, yeah, like I've never really, you know, I've never taken myself really seriously. I try to be as professional as possible when the time is right and when I need to be. But, you know, if someone's going to crack a joke or do something silly or stupid or weird, generally I'll be the first one to step up and humiliate myself. But, you know, it's all done. You know, I just believe in kind of it's a more of a defense mechanism, probably, more than anything, to make myself feel more comfortable. You know, it has that effect with other people as well. So even in a professional aspect, I mean, there's times.
Yeah, it's a good icebreaker for sure.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like when I got more into the later, like we're like completely like going off the rails in the conversation already. But when I got more comfortable with myself and the confidence came through, it definitely helped later on when I really kind of got back into doing, you know, personal work. And then that became my fine art work. And then that community blossomed for me. And I realized I had to do two things just as well as make photographs. One of them was to write about my photography, and the other one was to talk about it, you know, and, you know, at least attempt to speak succinctly about it. I really enjoy that part of it, and that comfortable feeling that I kind of got was the thing that made it so, that part of it so easy for me, because it, you know, you'll hear about that from people all the time, right? You know, oh, I don't like, you know, I want to let the work speak for itself. I don't need to tell anybody what it is that I'm doing. You know, picture's worth 1,000 words. Sure, but
can we use that as a soundbite from our podcast?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not untrue. A picture is worth 1,000 words, but which words? You know, wouldn't you rather be in control of the words that surround the photographs that you make? So, right. I mean, it's just communication, right? You know, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah. So you also write about other people's work now. So you've expanded that skill.
Yeah. And I guess that just kind of came naturally. Like I was not a great student in school. I mean, flat out, I just don't think that I ever took that part of it seriously. I always wanted kind of to do things my way, and that included doing things like writing, but I did have some early indication, and this is probably sounds egotistical. I was actually, when it came to writing and communicating, I was kind of just good at it from the start. And I don't really know why, other than maybe the fact that I used to read a lot, like a whole lot when I was younger. I don't read as much as I should now, but I mean, I really did when I was younger. And things like I would do, like, you know, spelling bees and spelling tests and all those kinds of things that were, you know, the nuts and bolts of the English language and communication skills. Those things all kind of came very naturally to me. And I do think the reading probably helped, you know, like my reading skill level was always above the grade, whatever grade I was in. And then my math skills were always like way below. So, you know, there was that was the yin and yang of it.
Yeah, me too.
I was terrible at math.
I'm in the same boat, my friend.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was really interested in was like history. So, and I always had questions about things. So all of those things kind of really lent themselves to bring me to what I kind of been doing on a day-to-day basis. You know, every day is a photographic day for me, like at least in part. I don't think there's ever a day where I don't think or act upon something photographically in some way, because I mean, that's just the life that I built for myself. And that's, you know, what I'm the most interested in. Like you said, now I'm writing about other people, and I really enjoy that. I mean, I think I'm curious by nature, and I'm always wanting to learn from what it is other people are doing. Since I wasn't good in school and I wasn't good with the old with book learning, it's better for me to kind of just come up with my own questions and, you know, have conversations, whether they're online, in person, or in, you know, even in written form.
Sure.
You know, a lot of the interviews I've done are usually, you know, are a lot of them are in written form, but not all. Right. So,
yeah. I was thinking about the first time that I got introduced to your photographs, and I, of course, couldn't remember the year, but I know it's right around the same time that I was starting Diffusion, because I think I saw your work in Light Leaks magazine.
Oh, wow.
I don't, you know, it would have been like, I think 2009-ish is when I started Diffusion, and I think that's actually the same year that I got exposed to your work for the first time. And then,
about right.
Yeah, and then after that, I met you in person. Actually, I think we put you in Diffusion before I met you in person. Is that true? Well, it doesn't matter.
I did
meet you at Photolucida, though, and I knew of your work. In fact, I might have put it on Plates to Pixels before I met you. No, that was after I met you. Well, I don't know. The timeline is very fuzzy for me. But the point is, it's been a few years that I've known about you. I was sort of doing the curation part and photographer at the same time, and then actually ended up spending more energy working on Diffusion than my own personal work. And so I can relate to your comment about every single day I'm doing something photographic. I may not be doing my own photography, but I'm doing something related to the photographic community or the process, or I'm learning a new process, or I'm designing a magazine, or I'm posting a portfolio on a website that I like. You know, that's sort of how I started doing this, was basically posting photos on portfolios on a website. That was my, you know, poor man's gallery, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, you know, that immediately became like the thing I was doing. And then I guess invited to do photo reviews. And I think I met you at my first Photolucida as you were a reviewee.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that was your first, you know, go at being a reviewer.
Yeah, I'd been a reviewer at Photo NOLA in 2010, and I think maybe that's what got me invited to go to Photolucida. People must have liked me because I wasn't disinvited. I mean, I actually got invited to something else.
Yeah. Huh. Who would have known?
Like, that guy's not an asshole.
That's, you know, I think in some ways, because the community is so kind of giving and willing to embrace people, I think that's the bar, right? Just don't be an asshole and you'll be accepted.
Right, exactly. We appreciate different perspectives. Just don't be an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as we know where that line is, we're okay.
Right. So anyways, my long story short, then I saw you're not just doing photography, but also starting to do other things. And tell us about your gig over at the now defunct. Well, they had a print and did they have print and web, or was it just web?
It wasn't even really on the web. God, it's only,
sorry,
hasn't even
it's
been
Blur.
That long. I've already kind of forgotten.
Yeah, it's Blur Magazine.
Yeah. Blur Magazine is where, you know, I'd really been concentrating heavily on my own photography for several years, and I had made a lot of inroads, and I had a lot, you know, I'd been in lots of groups, exhibitions. I was starting to do solo shows. You know, I had met you. And honestly, that in 2011, I think is when, was it 20? I think it was, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 2011 when I was there. That was the first time I showed up as a reviewee. Like a whole lot of stuff came out of that. You know, a lot of exhibitions, a lot of publications, and a lot of relationships that blossomed, and, you know, things came to fruition over time. You know, sometimes it took months, sometimes it took years. But looking back, a whole lot of great things came out of that year. After taking advantage of all those things and enjoying them, I can't even remember how this happened, but I got connected with, his name is Rob, he's still around, Robert Gojevic. He was the creator of Blur Magazine. And it was, you know, quote unquote, an international fine art photography publication. And it was, they had some blog articles online, and there were a lot of photographs, but it was really about selling a PDF download kind of magazine, right? It was a digital magazine.
Yeah.
So you could look at it on your laptop, your iPad, your phone, whatever.
Well, it had multiple formats too.
Yeah. And it did, he changed it up a little bit over the years, but in the end, he did it for 10 years. But towards the end, people weren't buying it anymore. He was starting to kind of go into debt a little bit over it. Not a huge amount, but the guy was a graphic designer, and he worked his ass off. He had, a wife and kids, and he was the breadwinner in the family, and he was immensely talented. He is. And I think there was a certain amount of frustration that came with dwindling sales, because he was probably putting more work into it towards the end and getting kind of less out of it. So eventually he pulled the plug. But that was 2018. But I came to him in 2014, and he wanted to put me in the magazine, which was great.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was like through an email exchange. I said something like, hey, if you ever need to know about anybody else who does great work, I have some friends and some people I know about that, I think you would be interested in seeing, that you might want to have in the magazine.
Yeah, totally.
And he literally came back and said, why don't you just be the editor? Or one of the, he had a couple of other people who were kind of acting as an editor, or contributor, I guess, for short periods of time. And I said, yeah, I'm like, I got a ton of ideas, a ton of work that I'd love to show you that isn't mine. And he's like, great, show me some suggestions. And then I would give him suggestions, and then he would start to send me submissions that he received. So there was a lot of, we were both sharing work back and forth, and then I would make selections, and, sometimes he would turn them down, and I would get a little bit disappointed, but there was always somebody else. There was always somebody else that I wanted to show. And he had kind of different themes early on, and then that kind of went away, and then that opened it up to more people and more places to show. And then he asked me to do an interview with one of the people that I chose, and I had never done that before. He always did them. And I just assumed, like, oh, well, he's the creator of the magazine. He does all the interviews. So it wasn't anything that I thought I would ever kind of step into or even ask about. So he asked me to do that. And and he's like, yeah, come up with 12, 15 questions. And I'm like, 12 or 15 questions? Oh my God. I'm like, I'm not, how long's that going to take? Like, I don't, And
that is a lot.
it's a lot. And looking back now, like through the years, reading other people's interviews and stuff, sometimes people will call it an interview and it's like three questions. And I'm like, well, I didn't really get a lot out of that. But I've seen other ones that are like 30 questions. And I'm like, well, that's crazy. It's
way too long.
Yeah. So I was kind of like, well, that is kind of a decent range. And it wasn't as hard as I thought. And in fact, it kind of, I would usually write more and then edit out the ones that I thought were the weakest. So I did that for 4 years. And then when it ended, I knew it was coming to an end, and I said, man, I really like this interviewing part. And if the magazine's going to end, well, that's going to go with it. So what am I going to do? I really like doing it. And that's when I came up with the idea of doing what is now called Catalyst Interviews. I thought, I'm not going to put them up. It's not going to be a magazine. It's not going to be for sale. It's just going to be me. I'm judge, jury, and executioner. I'm the ultimate dictator of the website. It's just going to be about me asking questions of photographers, and, maybe I'll introduce some commercial people, but it's probably going to be mostly, fine art, documentary kind of oriented work. I came up with the idea, in March or April of 2018, about 4 or 5 months before Blur ended. And he gave me his blessing as far as letting me use the interviews that I did for Blur. a kind of a launching point. So I had some sort of content to begin with. And then I conducted a few interviews ahead of time and, you know, built a website and set up all the social media accounts. And I spent, you know, some months kind of planning it and figuring out when I was going to do it. And, you know, ironically, today is the four-year anniversary of when I launched it.
Yeah, and you're nearing 100?
Yeah, there aren't that many on the website yet. There are a whole bunch of ones that are kind of in the hopper, ready to be brought out. And then some of them that ran on Analog Forever magazine that I eventually kind of bring over. I let them live there either in print or online for a number of months or years before I bring them over to Catalyst. Sure. Because sometimes that gives me a chance to either expand them or update them in some way as well.
Sure.
And of course, that was another thing that happened during that time is the birth of Analog Forever magazine.
Yeah, so how'd you get hooked up with Michael Balin on that one?
So that was something, again, it all kind of comes out of community building and the relationships that you form with people. And not being an asshole. I can't remember now. Maybe it was 2012, 2013. Michael he doesn't come from the world of photography. He comes from the world of finance. But he got into photography through a digital camera early on and then quickly kind of set it down. And, you know, he just didn't connect with it. And around that time, he picked up a Polaroid camera and started shooting Polaroids. And that's what kind of set him off creatively. And he really loved doing that. And he wanted to know more about it. He wanted to learn what other people were doing and embrace that in your own kind of, you know, life and workflow. So he started a magazine called Prime Magazine. And I can't remember, but he put me in that magazine. I think he only put out, I think, four, I can't remember now. He'll probably kill me when he hears this, but I don't remember how many copies there were. But the magazine ended and he switched it to what he called Prime Editions. And he started publishing books for specific artists instead. And as a interim point, he did the Prime Journal. So I was in that as well. And I helped give him some suggestions for that as well. It was, you know, we got along. It was just, you know, it was all through emails. We never spoke on the phone or online or anything like that. It was all just through email. But there was some camaraderie and, you know, a lot of back and forth that was, you know, supportive and creative and enlightening for both of us. And he got burned out on doing that project. He handed it off to somebody else to just kind of take the reins. And they inevitably kind of just let it go and die a slow death, and it went away. Because he wanted to spend time working on his own photography, and he was burned out on doing the Prime stuff. So he went back to doing that. And then after about a year, I guess he was in a conversation with a buddy of his having a drink at a bar, and his friend noticed that he wasn't kind of as energetic and being as creative as he had seen from him before. And Michael realized that he really loved doing Prime, but to do that and not get burned out, because he did it all by himself, like every single bit of it. You know, he designed the magazine, he designed the books, he did the website, he did the social media, he did almost all of the writing, you know, dozens and dozens of articles. And, you know, you can't sustain that for very long. Right. So he said, well, if I'm going to do something else, you know, I want to broaden it to other types of analog photography. And it has to be more than me. And I guess his buddy asked him, like, well, who would you ask? And he said, well, there's this guy named Michael Kirchhoff that I got along really well with when I was doing Prime. And the guy suggested, well, why don't you give him a call? So he called me right then and there. And I was sitting in this chair. I was sitting in my office. And the phone rang, and I answered it. And he's like, hey, this is Michael Balin. You remember me from Prime Editions? And I was like, oh, yeah, how's it going? How's the photography? You know, we chit-chatted a little bit. And he said, listen, I want to start another magazine. And I'm like, well, the first thing I thought was, well, you bailed on the last one because you just couldn't make it happen. You know, it was, right, it became too much. And I'm like, aren't you afraid that that's going to happen again? He said, that's why I'm calling you. I think it needs to be a team effort. So I need somebody like you to help me do this. And I said, that's great, but I'm already doing this thing. I'm already working on this thing called Catalyst Interviews because Blur's ending and I'm going in this other new direction. So there's already something I'm kind of working on. And he's like, well, I think it would be really great if we work together. And, you know, in the back of my head, I was just like, no way, man. I don't have, you know, thank you. Thank you. But I don't think I have time for this.
You don't have the bandwidth. Yeah.
Right. And then I said, sure, let's do it. Like, why did I just say that? And then I thought, well, you know, it was an opportunity, and I don't like letting opportunities pass me by. You know, I just think, why not at least try, right? You know, I'm trying to do my own thing with Catalyst, but why not do this too? You know, the worst that could come out of it is that I'll just get tired or bored or, you know, not want to do it anymore, and then I'll leave. And then, so while I was working on Catalyst, he and I started working on Analog Forever magazine. And then we got a couple of other people to join us as people who were kind of curators / writers / designers. And, you know, we needed more input rather than just the two of us. So it wasn't, wasn't him by himself, but it wasn't even a partnership. I mean, it's built upon our partnership, but there are other team members. And now there's 7 of us that work on the magazine in one way or another.
Right.
You know, there's been some kind of ebb and flow over it's almost been next month. It'll be 4 years for that. So over the 4 years, that's, you know, it's changed here and there. And it's obviously taken on a life of its own. So that Catalyst ended up being kind of taking a back seat to that. Because I used to do Catalyst on, like, there would be a new interview every 2 weeks. You know, I had to move to a more relaxed schedule for that. Because you also realize, like, people aren't, like, waiting bated breath for me to release another interview at Catalyst Interviews, right?
Doesn't have to be on a strict schedule.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because I either release a newsletter or talk about it on social media or something like that. That's the only reason anybody knows what's happening, right? Even though it was a regular schedule, nobody paid attention to it except me. And I was kind of like driving myself crazy with that to a certain degree. And then also Analog Forever took on a life of its own, and it's grown quite a bit. Outside of my own work, that takes up the bulk of my time. And that's fine. Yeah, I mean, I love doing it. It's community building and it's creative and I enjoy doing it. Between Catalyst and Analog Forever and working with you, I'm showing up at portfolio reviews. I'm on the other side of the table now a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't even know what I'm going to do when I want to start showing my own work again. You're like, can I switch back? I don't know.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, you can. I mean, it can. I just think you have to remember that you have a little bit of a leg up in a lot of ways. Because, you know, if you know what the reviewers seat is like, it makes it a little bit easier for you as a photographer
absolutely,
you know, being in their shoes, kind of like in reverse, how when you're reviewing you really can relate to the photographer and you've been there and done it. You know, it's a lot, there's not every reviewer does photography, right? You know, you're living on both sides of the table is kind of nice.
When I first shown some interest in, I reached out to one specific person. I'm not going to name any names because there was a little bit of resistance at first, because I wanted to get exposed to as much work as possible, because I had a need for that with Blur, then with Catalyst and Analog Forever. And then, so I reached out to somebody and there was a little bit of resistance because the idea was, well, we don't know if we want somebody who's known as a photographer to be reviewing other photographers' work.
Mm.
But in the end, I think I've been embraced by that more than anything, because I think by and large, more often people realize that you know what it's like. You know, you know both sides of the table, so you're kind of privy to ideas and information that not everybody gets a chance to know about, and how all those things kind of operate. And, you know, I have a deep appreciation for photography. I mean, that's where all of this comes from. I'm not making any money. I haven't been making any money off of the backs of any of the photographers. The only thing that gets sold is an occasional portfolio review or the print edition of Analog Forever magazine. And even that, we haven't, you know, it's so wildly expensive to do that, you know, we're at a break-even point, which I think I kind of actually feel very lucky to even be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Selling books and selling magazines is it's not really a money-making proposition, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
I do know. I can relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably better than anybody else. You know, I mean, you think about all of the, how many hours you've spent looking at the work, deciding what you want to show, doing the layout, doing, you know, coming up with the logo, coming up, you know, just the branding, the marketing, the social media, all of those things. How many hundreds of hours have you put into that?
Yeah. I'd hate to equate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, people go, oh, well, you make money off of that. It's like, you know what? I probably have made about 4 cents an hour then, because that's how much work it takes to do this. You know, if I wasn't on this podcast with you right now, I would be writing an article. I actually have a list. I have 3 interviews for Catalyst Interviews, 2 features for Analog Forever, and 2 interviews for Analog Forever, just for online consumption.
Well, and you just sent me a few portfolios as well. So,
and I sent, because again, you needed somebody to help kind of come up with articles for 112 Publishing, right? And, you know, again, the idiot that I am, I rose my hand and I said, Blue, pick me. I want to do that. And that, you know, and because it was already something that I was into doing. So I didn't think it would be that difficult. You know, I just thought it would be another aspect. And, you know, I like you and I like working with you. So it was, you know, it was kind of an easy call, even though it's just increased my workload that much more, but it hasn't been, you know, it's not like dramatically or anything, but.
Dude, but you just signed up for more though. So here we are doing these diffusion tapes.
Yeah.
Like, how many things can I do? But it was funny because I actually had you slated as one of my interviewees prior to even inviting you to be a co-host. So that kind of worked out well already. But so for you, why did you say yes to doing this totally different format where, you know, it's a little more organic, it's not formulaic, and you have to, like, you know, talk on screen and deal with looking at my dumb head?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a downside to everything. But
yeah, I mean, so why'd you say yes to the diffusion tapes?
It's something that I haven't done before, but it falls right
in
line.
No, he's lying already, you guys. He's lying. He's been on. He's been a guest on several podcasts, and he's also done some YouTube stuff with Art and Laras. So, you know, you're kind of
but that wasn't something that I thought I was going to continue to do. And I think it's different as a guest as it is a host or co-host, right?
Totally, yeah.
And, you know, this is on you. You're the one that invited me. So if this fails miserably, it's on you. Not so you were warned. But no, I mean, it is new to me though. Yes, I've been on podcasts and done a little bit of it before on YouTube and things like that, but it's been very limited. So this is kind of more, to me, it feels more polished and refined. You know, we've already had conversations about, you know, well, how do we do this? What happens at the beginning? What happens during the questioning? Who do we pick? Things like that. You know, we've already, you know, suggested people to one another for future podcasts. So, And again, it falls in line with what I've already been doing, but it's different enough so that it's kind of fresh to me, at least, and interesting. Because that, I think that that's probably one of my biggest faults is that if I do anything for a really long period of time and only that thing, I'll get bored and not burned out. I'll just kind of get bored and want to move on from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why I've kind of gone, you know, like from concentrating in my commercial photography to concentrating on fine art photography to then writing and editing and interviewing. These are all different. They're all photographic in one way or another, but they're all different enough to kind of keep my interest level high. So this is kind of just another. I don't want it to sound like that's not a big deal, but it is another step in kind of my own personal and creative evolution, I guess, as somebody that's, I guess I kind of want to be known as somebody who's more than a photographer, you know, and I don't want to say just a photographer because being a photographer is kind of a pretty great thing. And there's people out there that are just so much more wildly talented than me, but doing this gives me a chance to interact with them, speak with them, and learn. You know, you and I from the get-go, right, from that first meeting at Photo Lucida, I think we got along. It was very comfortable quickly, right? Like there was, you know, I think that we have a rapport, and I think that, you know, you laugh at enough of my stupid jokes to make this work. And you know, when I was there as a reviewer, August? When was I there? April? As a reviewer,
April,
you know, and we participated in the book fair together. We went out to dinner together. And I think that comfortable nature that we have made it easier for you to, you know, pick me, I guess, as a co-host, as somebody who would probably want to do it, would want to put the time into it and be serious enough about it to make an honest go of it. So
yeah, well, here's the real truth is I'm threatened by Analog Forever. So, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, right? That's the real reason this is happening.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too that you say that because one of the things that Michael Beelan and I had talked about a while ago was, you know, he's constantly coming up with ideas and think, oh, should we try this? What if we do this? Like, he's like the idea guy, right? And I'm the one who's like, like shooting down all of his ideas. Like, no, maybe ask me in 2 weeks.
Right.
No. Okay. We'll do that. You know, like,
right.
He's like incredibly also very gracious and great about working with me and my, you know, my process of how I choose people and how I interview people and things like that. But one of his ideas a while ago was, hey, what if we did a podcast? And I'm like, fuck no, I don't want to do a podcast. Funny. No. Like, that sounds like, that's like a whole nother full-time job.
Yeah.
And you know, because you're the one that's, like, I'm stepping into this, right? So
right.
He's probably a little bit miffed at me for doing that. He's not. He's, but, you know, there's probably a little bit of disappointment.
We should have him on so we can chat with him. So, you know, that'll put him on the spot.
Yeah. He's got more energy than both of us put together times 10. So I'm sure he would be up for it. He wanted to do some kind of Analog Forever branded podcast. And I was just like, I don't have the time to learn about how to do it. So, and you in asking me to be co-host has kind of, you've solved that problem for me, right? I don't know how you've got the knowledge and the know-how and the technical skills behind pulling all of this off. I just show up and blather on and on about stuff.
Right. Well, that's a great position to be in. It makes it like I can do the fun part and then it just like happens, right?
yeah, it's kind of like, well, in a way it's like I'm like the director of my own career. I'm a partner in Analog Forever. I'm a partner in this, and I'm a partner in the in writing for 112 Publishing. But it's me kind of being able to direct how much time and how much energy I can put into each one of them, so that it, honestly, right, and selfishly, so that it works for me.
Yeah. Well, and balancing like your day job and, yeah, you know, that can be demanding at times as well. Yeah. Speaking of your day job, let's talk about that. So
sure.
Are you called a gaffer, or do you do much more than that?
You know, it's, again, that's like multi kind of multi-layered. So I do, yeah, I do my own commercial photography. I do it less than I used to, because I'm doing all of these other things now too. Because lighting was such a key part of what I did, and I think at least did well enough, so other people will ask me kind of to do lighting for them as well. And it's basically like an assistant position, but you're also kind of like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like a lighting designer, but for still photography. Mm-hmm. So I do that a lot for a couple of really large media companies here in Los Angeles. And they have staff people that I work with where, you know, I have access to their studios and their equipment. Mm-hmm. And when they have certain projects that they need me on, they just call me up and I say, yeah, I'll be there. And, you know, let's make it happen. And they're usually, you know, they're celebrity related a lot of the time. They're, you know, they generally revolve around movies and television. Mm-hmm. And so
like promo type stuff.
Yeah. So like you'll see them, you know, ads in magazines, billboards, things like that. Obviously a lot of web advertising now. And a lot of that has kind of grown into, because the role of the still photographer has now grown into oftentimes the role of the, like a content producer in doing motion-based projects. Mm. A lot of them are web-based, obviously. In fact, I would say kind of the majority of them are, really. But you still, you know, it meant having to learn a new skill set. And again, it's kind of like a director's position. So I get involved with that as well.
I see.
And then, so that's why you might think, oh, well, he's a gaffer, because that's what, I mean, gaffers are essentially lighting designers for motion-based projects, whether they're film, television, web-based, right, whatever. So, I do I do that as well. And the beauty of it is every project's different. Every day is different. You know, there'll be a day where I'll be locked in this office and I'll be writing all day or planning, you know, scheduling, you know, when I'm going to run interviews or articles or work on the print edition of Analog Forever. And then I'm in Cancun the next day,
right,
working on a shoot for a hotel chain, working, doing things, you know, lighting rooms and people for both film and stills. And then I'll be there for a week and then I'll be somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about when we were talking about doing the podcast. It's like, well, where are you at right now, Michael?
Yeah. Well, in fact, we were going to do one of our tests earlier. And I, you know, I took everything with me. I was on a job in Santa Barbara. I had to quarantine for several days before the job started. And so I was kind of locked in a hotel room in Santa Barbara, just basically writing and doing what I would normally do in my office at home. So I took, you know, all the podcasting stuff and the monitor and you know, laptop. I took, you know, I basically built an office in this hotel room for several days and continued doing what I needed to do to make best use of my time.
Yeah, good pre-planning.
Yeah, and if that was the case, like if we had something else scheduled, if we scheduled something and in the evening after a day of shooting, whatever, you know, I could be anywhere in the world and still continue to do this. So, as well as the photographer, and you could be there or you could be somewhere else. I mean, that's, it's opened up a lot of opportunities, I think, to us in terms of doing.
Oh, so the diffusion takes we took a long break, and part of that was I needed to be a little more organized with season 2, because it took me a long time to release season one. You know, I'd release one, and then it was supposed to be like at least one a month, but like sometimes several months would lapse. And so then it was like, oh, I gotta like get my shit together. And I'd have like two in the queue ready, edited, ready to release. So then, you know, they'd come out within a month of each other, but then the next one would be like 3 months out. So talk about regular schedule. Really, it was like my release schedule was ridiculous because, you know, I'm busy. I was also producing Diffusion Print Mag at the same time. So that,
right.
You know, that always takes precedence over the Diffusion Tapes. So the Diffusion Tapes is more like a side project of Diffusion, you know, anyway. Mm-hmm. It's supplemental. In fact, the reason I started it was because I had removed most of my articles from Diffusion and just started focusing on the work and and the design of the book, you know, turning it into this like more, you know, like a heavily designed and curated magazine. But turning it more into a book format instead of magazine. So that was sort of the process. But in that, I decided, okay, grow our website and put the articles there because it's free. And I'm not paying for real estate, you know, like I am in Diffusion. So it's like, okay, online, I'm paying a flat fee. It doesn't matter how many fucking pages I put on it. I can put as much articles and content on it, and it's going to cost me the same at the end of the day. Whereas Diffusion, the more articles I add, the more expensive my book gets. And I'm just like, well, I could take less words and have more images. So so that was sort of the evolution. But in that, basically, I came to this conclusion that really what I enjoy the most about going to photo reviews and doing any type of photo event, a gallery opening, is the conversations that I'm having with people. So that's really was like, well, what do I like to do the most? You know, what is my interest now? And it's kind of like you were saying, if I can't do the same thing over and over, I get bored, you know? So that's, for me, it's the same thing. Like I want to push myself to learn more. At the same time, I've been learning a ton about audio and video and production, my day job, and it sort of coincided at the same time of me learning how to do a podcast and editing and getting the right equipment and all that stuff for audio, which I didn't know anything about audio prior to, you know, saying, hey, I'd like to, you know, start a podcast, kind of like Michael, and you were like, hey, we should do this. It's like, well, yeah, we have to learn all that shit to get there, you know. So it took me a good year to like get the right equipment, figure out how I was going to do it. You know, I was, because they were face to face, I had to make sure that I was kind of on point with it. So, because I only had that opportunity if we were, you know, most of the sessions were me at a photo review or somebody was from out of town in town for something. So it was like, I couldn't like necessarily go. I just didn't want to mess them up. You know, I had like a limited moment to capture it, you know? So, yeah. And I made mistakes. I made some technical issues where stuff didn't get recorded, and that was a huge bummer. It's like, oh man. So it was basically me saying, hey, let me start Diffusion again, learn a whole new set of skills. You know, I didn't know how to publish a magazine. I didn't know anything about any of that when I started that, you know? So it was like, so I'm like, oh, here we go. This will be fun. But it's like, it's very technically challenging to decide to take on a bunch of new stuff. Luckily, like I said, I had a day job that sort of supplemented the work so I could actually put it into action in my day job. It's like, oh, I can record voiceover, for instance. You know what I mean? Like, I can do that now, which before I had no idea what I was doing. I still feel very amateur, but, you know, it's the Diffusion Tapes. Come on.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned that, you know, it wasn't really the scheduling that was difficult early on. Like you knew you had a lot of people you wanted to talk to and you had the opportunities to talk to them. It was, so then is it the editing that just takes, is it just everything at the back end that creates more time?
The post-production was, I'm much quicker and better at it now, but like because I didn't know what I was doing, it took me a long time to kind of get a handle on it, especially like making sure my recordings were clean and I didn't have to do a lot of post-production on that. You know, they started out a bit rough. You know, I didn't have a handle on the technical piece of it. So then it would create, as you know, anytime you kind of fuck things up in the beginning, then you have a lot of post-production nightmares to deal with.
Sure. And
luckily, audio, for the most part, is, you know, it's more forgiving than like video editing and stuff like that. So,
right.
which made me become more precise with my editing, where I could tighten things up and I could, shrink down the length of things and get rid of any awkward pauses. And you know what I mean? Like everything was, for me, I just dove in. I was like, I'm going to just figure out how to do this, do it right. You know, make it sound good. There's still a ton of it. Like I've always said, hey, even in photography, I'm not the most technical dude. So, mm-hmm. I'm not going to even be able to speak the language sometimes, but I know what I know how things are supposed to be. I know how it's supposed to be. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just not, it's like, well, I was like you in school. Like, I wasn't that great at math and like the science, not so much, So anything that's like technical, which is sort of ironic since most of my job is technical now in a lot of ways. So the photography and the video production and the editing and it's like my day job is definitely very technical. Sort of a misnomer for me to say I'm not a technical person. But when it comes to when I was learning photography and they were teaching me the zone system, God bless Ansel Adams, but I hated that shit. It was just not my thing. I just could not get my brain around it. And I got it in concept. Like I get it, but oh, yeah. I just want to look at it. I don't want to do math. I just want to look at it and see, like, I want it to be better visually. Mm-hmm. I'm not real good about, but even to this day, my photography is like, it's a little rough around the edges, always.
I was just thinking that term. Yeah, exactly.
That's just me. I'm a bit rough around the edges,
Yeah, I think that's why we get along so well, too, is I think we're very similar like that. We've kind of taken a similar approach to learning and doing things like this. So, and that's what, when you approached me about being co-host, I was like, well, yeah, that sounds great. But, I got some questions, and you sent me like, oh, this is, you need to get a microphone and you need to get a better camera. And I'm like, I got to get a what? Like, do I have to? Oh, okay. And then I'm looking at this, I'm looking at your suggestions and I'm like, I don't even know how to pick, like, which ones do I go? And you helped me out a lot along the way, but those are the things that you had to go through in order to get to where you were at now. So,
Right. Yeah. Well, cool, man. I think it's going to be fun. Hey, I was going to ask you, do you play music?
No. Everybody assume it's the hair. Everybody assumes that I do. When you have long hair, there are a lot of assumptions that are made. And I take that back, though. I do own a couple of guitars. I can't play them. I picked up the guitar a long time ago when I broke my hand. I broke my hand mountain biking, and I thought, what a great way of physical therapy. Like, if I can, hit notes on the fretboard of a guitar, that will help me, in the recovery of strengthening my hand. So I kind of, even though I'm like completely immersed in music as a fan, I just don't play any of my own. So.
Sure. No, I had to say that because no, I don't. I tried learning guitar, tried piano. It's not I'm not passionate enough to stick with anything about it. You can tell, like, my interest in art and photography and the publishing and all that stuff is so intense. Like, it's all consuming sometimes, right? But then when I tried to learn music, I was like, it's not all consuming like the other things I'm passionate about. It's just not my gig. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I think you mentioned at the bar something about people always ask if you're a musician because of your hair.
Yeah. And when
I had to ask you live and maybe just settle it.
Yeah. It happens all of the time when I travel, when I'm in an airport and you're carrying, if you're traveling with a lot of gear, so you have like these cases of stuff, nobody knows what's inside and you have long hair, like people are like, oh, are you that guy in that band?
Are you a roadie?
And I used to, I didn't do it a lot. I did it a couple of times. Before he passed away, I told people that I was Jeff Hanneman, who was the guitar player, one of the guitar players for Slayer. And people would believe me. People would, oh,
people
my God.
Believe you? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then I'd have, they'd ask for an autograph.
I probably would.
Yeah. And I'd be like, no, I was just kidding.
Sign my cleavage.
Yeah. Well, then I might. Yeah. Sure.
sure, I'll just forge it.
Yeah, exactly. There's exceptions to every rule. But I wouldn't mind, trying to play the guitar again one day. I feel like I would get disappointed quickly. Like, I know what can be done. So if I started playing guitar and learning today, if by next week I wasn't Eddie Van Halen, I would be just pissed off at myself. It's like, if I can't just shred immediately, then I'm out. Forget it. I'm
out. Yeah. All right. I got it. That's funny. Well, so I think this has probably been a pretty nice conversation.
Yeah. You've had enough of me.
I mean, I was thinking when you were talking about Michael asking you to be a part of Analog because he needed a team.
Mm-hmm.
That's similar to how I felt with hosting the Diffusion Tapes. It's like, I enjoyed it, but I think the only thing that would actually get me back behind the mic is to have the podcast designed the way I want it to be, mm-hmm. rather than forcing it. So this whole new format, I think, is going to be much more interesting for the listener, much mm-hmm. more interesting for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you have to come fly up and relight my studio.
I could do that.
Well, there you have it, folks, my new co-host Michael Kirchhoff. As you heard in our talk, we have a lot in common, and I'm looking forward to sharing the second season with you with our fantastic guest list we've lined up. I hope you enjoy this new collaboration. Like I said in the talk, if you can beat them, join them. Thanks for the fantastic talk, Michael, and cheers to many more. Up next, our invigorating conversation with the talented Molly McCall.
I always saw photography as kind of like a part of something else, or it was a medium that I could change and use in different ways. And I still think of it that way, of how many different things can I make out of this one thing? I play games like that